The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Aluminum Company of America against the Central People's District. You may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. We are here because we believe that the Ninth Circuit fundamentally misconceived the background and history and purposes of the statute enacted in 1980, and as a consequence, also misconceived the congressional solution to the problem of the Northwest region. I would like to dwell just a brief moment on the history, because I think it is instructive of how the preference problem fits into the congressional solution. Under the Bonneville Project Act of 1937, Bonneville was authorized to serve all classes of customers with power. Those classes of customers included not only those who were accorded statutory preference and priority, but also utilities which were privately owned and which had no such priority, federal agencies, and my clients, the DSIs, the Direct Service Industries, which are principally aluminum companies operating in the Northwest. Now, the service to the aluminum companies, to the DSIs, has certain characteristics which are important as we move into the congressional considerations in 1980. Among those considerations are that the load is interruptible. Unlike most industries, or indeed most utilities, it is possible, without absolute and complete harm to operations, to stop electricity, at least for short times, on an immediate basis in order to protect service to other customers. At the same time, because of the character of the DSI load, it is also possible to serve that load with what is called non-firm energy, essentially energy the production of which cannot be guaranteed based on historic water conditions. As a consequence, over the years, the DSI load was conceived by Bonneville as having unique values to the Northwest in the form of providing reserves to protect firm power loads by others. There was only one problem with the system as it existed in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, and that is that water was finite. Dams were built on all acceptable locations, environmentally acceptable locations, and by the early 1970s, all the best estimates were that the finite amount of power being generated by Bonneville would run out. And that's where the preference clause of the 1937 statute was triggered. First went the private utilities. Their contracts expired in 1973. All service to them was terminated by Bonneville except for spot purchases thereafter. In 1975, 1976, the DSIs were advised that their contracts, which had been in existence since the early 60s, would, when they expired, most likely not be renewed, again because of the existence of the preference clause. The consequence was, and the picture which emerged was, that the only power that would be available would go to preference customers, preference utilities alone, and that would be inadequate. But the anomaly was that the Bonneville Project Act of 1937 was intended to serve consumers and farmers in the region, and yet only a portion of the region was served by the preference utilities. In fact, I believe you will see in the record that Oregon was generally not served by preference utilities, whereas Washington was largely served by preference utilities, and the disparity in rates that emerged in the 70s caused, needless to say, a considerable political problem in the Northwest. What happened in sum was that preference emerged as the problem, not an adequate solution to the problems of the Northwest. The only solution that was possible was congressional, and that is why the statute was enacted in 1980. Now, the statute ended what was called a regional civil war, and it ended it in a manner which we think is straightforward. It decreed as its first element of legislation that the power which was to be available would be legislative allocated, not allocated administratively. Priority and preference, the old preference clause, after all, was a congressional direction to the administrator, giving him instructions as to how he, the administrator, should allocate power. That is what the preference clause does. It governs administrative allocations. The heart of the statute in 1980 was to take the allocation function away from the administrator and legislate it directly by statute.
Mr. Popofsky, do we find this heart of the statute in any one section or subsection?
We do not find it in any one section of the 85 pages of legislation, but I believe you will find it mostly in Section 5, where the sales to classes of customers are mandated. And that's the key, Justice Rehnquist. You will see in Section 5 that the administrator is mandated directly by Congress to enter into contracts, the terms of which are specified. Now, historically, the preference clause has always honored the existence of contracts. Contracts could be performed in accordance with their terms without an invasion by a preference customer, so long as that they had been validly entered into in the first instance. And what Congress was doing in mandating contracts for all four classes of customers, note, for the preference customers, for the privates, for the federals, and directly for the DSIs, what Congress was doing was saying, we mandate directly by statute this amount of power, and we'll come to that, of course, this amount of power for these classes of customers. Now, we know that we are mandating more power than Bonneville has. We know that. And the answer to that is, we will also authorize Bonneville for the first time to acquire the resources necessary to serve these contracts. And then we will do one more remarkable thing. So there can be no doubt and no dispute, in 5G7, we will create a fiction. We'll write a fiction right into the statute which says the administrator shall be deemed to have sufficient power to enter into these contracts.
Mr. Popofsky, I have the same question, really, I guess, that Justice Rehnquist has already asked. Section 5 starts out by saying all power sales under this act shall be subject at all times to the preference and priority provisions of the prior
That's
statute.
Correct.
Now, what is it in Section 5 that mandates the allocation that you describe?
If you look at further into Section 5 in the B sections, Your Honor, you will find the terms of contracts that are mandated. For example, 5G1, I'm working in the statute, Your Honor, B38, 5G1.
5G1 is on page 3 of the petition for certiorari.
And I was also referring to the appendix to the petition. But in 5G1, there is a mandate that the administrator shall commence negotiations. In 5D1B, the crucial provision, after the effective date of this act, the administrator shall offer, it's mandatory language, in accordance with subsection G of this section, to each existing DSI contract, etc. And indeed, if you look at the legislative hearings, the committee reports, they are described throughout as required, mandated contracts. And I believe it is because of the character that they are mandated directly by Congress, that Section 5A of the statute can be read to subsist with them in accordance with its terms. 5A applies to all power which is not subject to a valid and lawful contract. And a valid, lawful, initial contract are those specified as mandated by the statute.
But, Mr. Papasi, 5A doesn't say that. Perhaps it should, maybe by implication. But it says all power sales under this Act. It doesn't make any exception.
I agree, Your Honor. It absolutely says that. And the only question, therefore, before the Court is how does one reconcile a mandate by Congress, a congressional allocation, if you will, of power with the flat statement in 5A that all sales are subject to preference? And the answer to that, Your Honor, is plain. Preference has never required the invasion or invalidation of a lawful, valid contract. For example, in the 1970s, the clients that I represent, the DSIs, had lawful contracts which were going to expire in 1981 to 1991. There was not adequate power by 1976, and yet nobody suggested that because that there was now an insufficiency of power, that those contracts were in any way invadable. They were valid according to their terms, notwithstanding the coexistence of a preference right. Preference attaches only at the time of the offer of a new contract to competing applicants. And here Congress preempted the process. They said, we will take the applications ourselves through the legislative process. All four classes will be served.
Would you go back a minute and spell out a little more what you mean by preference attaches only at the time the contract is offered?
Yes. Under the preference clauses of various statutes, as they have been interpreted throughout the federal courts, preference attaches as a directive to the administrator under a statute who is marketing federal power. It attaches at the time when the administrator has power for sale, and he announces that, and there are competing applicants. And if among the competing applicants, for example, a preference utility on the one hand and a DSI on the other, both apply, then there was not enough power to serve both, at that point preference would govern and direct the administrator to serve the preference agency. If there was sufficient power for both, on the other hand, he would serve both. If, on the other hand, he had actually entered into that contract, goes ahead and enters into that contract, and 5 years later on, assume it's a 20-year contract, 5 years later on, a preference utility comes along and says, hey, I like some of that power, and I have a statutory preference. No court has ever held he has a right to invade an existing contract lawful under the preference clause when entered into. And it's for that very reason you will find in the statute, a requirement that in the contracts for the private utilities, there's a 5-year pullback clause to protect the preference notion that after 5 years, if power has become insufficient for any reason, those contracts can be interrupted by direction of Congress. And that is the historic functioning of the preference clause and why Section 5A can coexist in a cohesive and integrated legislative scheme with the mandated contracts of our clients.
Mr. Gounsfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The government's argument boils down to two points I'd like to stress this morning. First, that the Bonneville Administrator's decision fully accords with express statutory directive and with congressional intent. And that alone should suffice to reverse the Ninth Circuit's decision. Our second point is that even if other interpretations of the Act are possible, that the Administrator's decision is a reasonable one and is therefore entitled to substantial deference. I'm not going to spend much time putting the Regional Act in perspective. I think Mr. Popovsky has done that. I'd like to emphasize only that at the time that the Act was under consideration, the region faced three pressing concerns: an impending power shortage, uncertainty in planning for the future, and a great disparity in rates paid by consumers. What was needed and what was recognized as the solution to this was a legislative plan of allocation. And for this, the region turned to Congress. The act that Congress passed is a careful balance of interdependent factors. In the end, the competing interests that addressed Congress arrived at a compromise. And in this compromise, all customers derived benefits and all were required to make concessions in order that the common good of planning for power could be served. Now, in this proceeding, the respondents are seeking to upset that balance. They're trying to do that by preserving the enormous benefits they got in the Regional Act while rejecting the trade-offs that they had to make. Now, obviously, the statute and its subject matter are highly technical and complex. But the legal issues in the case are straightforward and relatively simple. And in our view, they're easily believed under well-established rules of statutory construction and administrative law. The key to the case is the express directive of Section 5D1B in the Regional Act that Bonneville shall offer to each existing DSI an initial long-term contract that provides for an amount of power equivalent to that which such customers entitled under its 1975 contract.
May I interrupt right there with just one question?
Surely.
Under your view of the issue in the case, if your side wins, will the DSI customers get the same or a greater amount of power than they would have gotten under the prior law?
They would be entitled to the same amount of power.
Would they not get a little more because they have an additional protection?
Well, they have an additional protection as to the first quartile. They have less protection as to the second quartile. And what I would have to do, and I'm not in a position to do that, is to predict which set of circumstances, namely those that trigger first quartile interruptions or those that trigger second quartile interruptions, would be the more likely to occur. In Congress's view, it was likely that the amount of power actually received, the energy received by the DSIs, would go up. And I believe that the DSI's reply brief addresses that in reference to the comments in the Senate committee report, indicating the Congress's expectation that the energy received would go up to between 85% and 96% of the total contract load, which was somewhat more than they had actually received under the 1975 contract.
So your answer is that Congress thought it would be higher, but you're not sure they were right.
Congress thought it would be higher, and that was their determination to make.
Is it correct that if we take your opponent's interpretation of the law, they would get the same amount of power?
Well, not necessarily, because what would happen under the respondent's view of the case, as I understand it, is that the total entitlement to power would be, and I might add under what I understand is the Ninth Circuit's view of the case, the total entitlement to power for the DSIs is not the full contract load, not what is specified in the 75 contracts as the amount of power, but rather three-quarters of that. Because as the Ninth Circuit believed, it was only three-quarters of that that had been allocated.
Well, so it's a right to three-quarters and a possibility of more.
Well, but that's not the way the 75 contracts work. The 75 contracts indicated in Section 4, and that's at page N2 of the appendix to the petition, that the amount of power that is sold is the full amount, the full contract load. And those were the figures that were before Congress when it was considering the Regional Act. I might also add that the questions as to interruption do not appear in Section 4 of the 1975 contracts, but rather they are elsewhere. The amount of power is clearly the full amount and was clearly understood by everyone to be the full contract load. Now, on this question of the amount of power, in our view, what we were required to do was to offer a contract that provided an amount of power equivalent to the amount they were entitled to in 1975. And as you can see from the chart on page 20 of the joint appendix, we have done precisely that. We offered new contracts for the same amount of power that the DSIs were entitled to before. And in our view, there is really nothing else that need be addressed in this case, since the 1981 contracts entitled the DSIs to no greater amount of power. Bonneville clearly followed an express and specific statutory command. Now, unfortunately, the Ninth Circuit, in its initial opinion, did not even address this issue, amount of power. In footnote 9 of its original opinion, which is at page 65 of the Joint Appendix, it specifically declined to decide whether the new contracts involved a greater amount of power than the old ones. It was wrong for the court to do that. The issue had to be addressed, and eventually when the court did address it in its amended opinion, it added footnote 4 that says, in effect, the 75 contracts never entitled the DSIs to the top quartile, and therefore the new contracts can do no more. The point is that that's wrong. As I indicated, Section 4 of the 75 contracts specified an amount of power, and it was the full amount. Now, because the top quartile was subject to interruption, which is something that happens under a different section of those contracts, the court concluded that the DSIs are now limited to the same terms of service as they were before. What it did was it confused the notion of amount of power and terms of service. And I'd like to point out why that's wrong. First of all, the Regional Act is to the contrary. And the House Commerce Report makes clear at page D-123 of the appendix to the petition that Section 5D-1 refers to the amount of power to which the DSIs were entitled and not to the amount that happened to be used at a particular time. And in addition, there were tables that were listing what the DSI entitlement was and what Congress understood it to be. And those figures in the House and the Senate reports are references to the full contract load under the 1975 contracts. Now, the Ninth Circuit also ignored was the clear congressional directive that Bonneville take new steps to improve the quality of service to the top quartile and to serve that quartile as if it were firm. Now, that language, as if it were firm, is from the Senate Committee report at page F-74 of the appendix to the petition. And while the Ninth Circuit acknowledged that this was the congressional plan and said so in footnote 7 of its opinion, it didn't understand the significance of the plan. Instead, it dismissed the committee reports as ambiguous and meaningless, but the Court of Appeals really made no effort to understand what those reports were about, and in particular, the Court made no reference to Section 5F of the Act, another provision dealing with the question of when the preference customers are entitled to assert that preference. Now, even if the question of the quality of service is reached, it's our position that the respondents are wrong. Unlike the situation that existed before, when the DSI's top quartile could be interrupted for any reason, the Regional Act specifies that the DSI load shall provide a portion of the administrator's reserves. That is, it may be interrupted only for firm power loads within the region. And that is in Section 5D1A of the Act, and it is language that's consistent with Section 5B1 of the Act. Now, the import of that language is made crystal clear in the Senate report. That's at page F-47 and F-48 of the appendix of the petition. And that report states that it is not intended that the administrator's reserves will be used to protect other than firm loads. So it was Congress that changed the status of the DSI reserve and the terms of interruption. It was not an arbitrary or capricious act of the administrator. And let there be no mistake about it, Congress was absolutely well aware of what it was doing. While this complex legislation was pending, Representative Kazin, the chairman of the House Interior Subcommittee on Water and Power, inquired of Bonneville just how the DSI load would be served. And the administrator responded and told Representative Kazin that he would do precisely what he eventually did, namely that it would be 25% would be subject to restriction to serve firm loads of other customers. This statement was adopted verbatim in the House report and approved by the Senate. The act was passed with this understanding. Bonneville went out and did it.
Mr. Gansby, I take it your position is that this is the only way the statute could be construed, or is the statute reasonably construable another way?
Well, our first point is that this is the only way the statute could be construed. We had to offer contracts to the DSIs. It had to be for the amount of power equivalent to what they got before, and it had to provide reserves.
Bonneville had taken the course that's suggested by your opposition, would it have violated the statute?
If it had offered less than the amount of power entitlement of the 1975 contract, it probably would have been a violation of the statute.
Well,
and that's one of the reasons why...
You have to say it would have.
It would have, but we didn't do it.
Your position just isn't that the statute is construable one way or another and that the Bonneville chose one of the reasonable courses and that we should defer to... That isn't your point.
Our first argument is that there was only one way it could be done, and it was done that way. And it was the way that Congress was told it would be done.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm wrong about that, and there is another interpretation, and Bonneville was not required to do what it did, it was certainly a reasonable reading of the statute for the administrator to do what he did.
And what was the Ninth Circuit's answer to... was the Ninth Circuit of the view that the statute had to be read the other way?
The Ninth Circuit was of the view...
It just preferred to read it another way.
Well, it preferred to read it the other way, even though, as it said, that Bonneville's interpretation was supported by the legislative history. It also said that Bonneville's policy may serve the purpose of the preference clause.
They seem to think the statute was readable either way, but that it just thought... It just preferred another reading.
What it did was it focused on the preference clause. Its original opinion spoke only of the preference clause and didn't address the amount of power issue. There was really no way for this case to be decided without the amount of power issue being decided for reasons I think you suggest in your question. If we did what we were expressly told to do, we complied with the statute and other provisions would have to be put into harmony with the specific directive we followed. If we violated the specific directive of 5D1B, then the provisions of this contract would be invalid, not because of a preference claim, but because we violated the specific provision telling us what we were to offer to the DSIs. And I'd just like to add one other comment to what the Ninth Circuit had to say that supports our view in the case, is that the Ninth Circuit had to say at page 13 of its opinion in the appendix to the petition, that under Bonneville's construction, all of its customers would benefit. And that was the point that Congress was trying to achieve when it passed the Regional Act. It was trying to benefit all of the customers. Now, for the reasons outlined in the briefs, because of the interdependency and the need to sell to the DSIs, the benefits of that reserve in subsidizing the exchange program, the lower rates for the customers of privately owned utilities, all of this pattern that mixes together, if we start tugging at one point of this ball of yarn, it's going to begin to unravel. Now, Congress put this together very carefully. We think it should remain in place as the administrator concluded. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Waldron.
Thank you, Mr. Justice Berger. May it please the court. For over 40 years, Congress, through three specific statutes, required BPA to sell this non-firm energy to my clients first. We built our systems in reliance upon this essential and long-standing priority. I agree with the Solicitor General that what you have here is a straightforward question of statutory application. Did Congress in the Regional Act change this essential and longstanding priority? The simple answer to that is no. And let me look at the problem that Congress faced. Too much demand in the Northwest, not enough supply. The solution was not, as petitioners would suggest, to take something from my clients and give it to them. The solution, as Senator Henry Jackson, the sponsor of the bill, said, was simply to bake a bigger pie and for the first time give Bonneville the authority to acquire resources. In fact, I believe his statement is the act will give Bonneville the authority to buy power to serve non-preference customers without offending the principles of preference. That is what is unique about this statute. That is why it passed after 4 years of discussion with a regional consensus. Now, the answer to the question posed, did Congress change this, is the simple and straightforward language of the Act, the two provisions, one of which Justice Stevens has already referred to. Congress said in straight language, all power sales shall be subject to this priority. And later at Section 10C, nothing shall abridge, diminish, affect, or change in any way whatsoever this priority. What Congress did is bake a bigger pie, as Senator Jackson used that analogy in introducing the bill, drew a line down the middle of it, and said, this side is the priority customers, that's why they're supporting this. And this side over here, we're now going to give Bonneville the authority to buy resources, and that will serve the needs of the non-preference customers and provide rate relief.
Mr. Waldron, you don't argue that Section 10 means that the act that we're construing here didn't change the Bonneville Act.
Justice Rehnquist, Bonneville sells power under three statutes, the Bonneville Project Act, the Flood Control Act. It has some dams that were built by the Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Reclamation, and the Bureau of Reclamation Act. And those statutes also provide the preference and priority. And that is what Section 10C refers to.
Well, but are you arguing that the act that we're here considering didn't really make any changes in the Bonneville Act? That it presumably succeeded?
Well, it didn't make changes in the Bonneville Act. What it did was add to the Bonneville Act. It retained the priority of the Bonneville Act. It refers in numerous sections to the federal-based system. There were federal resources from the Bonneville Project Act in place at the date of the passage of the Act. Those are the resources, for example, that generate non-firm energy. What the Regional Act did was add to that and for the first time give Bonneville the authority to buy power. And then, when it gave Bonneville that authority to buy power, in specific sections, it basically told Bonneville how much, through sections 5, B, C, and D.
Well, to take 5D1B, which your opponents rely on, which says the administrator shall offer, in accordance with subsection G, an initial long-term contract that provides an amount of power equivalent to that which such customers entitled. I'm sure you know the provision.
Yes, sir.
Now, what is your interpretation of the sort of contract that the administrator was required to offer under that section?
Congress would be required to offer a contract that provided the same rights to power that they had under their that Bonneville would be required to offer a contract that gave them the same rights to power that they had under their 1975 contracts.
5D1B talks about an amount of power.
It talks about an amount of power equivalent to that to which they were entitled. And that's what Bonneville did not do. Under their 1975 contracts, they were not entitled to this priority to non-firm. That is undisputed. We had that priority to non-firm. That is the change in question that the Bonneville administrator did in this case, and it's the essence of what prompted this lawsuit to come before the courts. He changed the amount of power that they would receive. Mr. Gansreed was looking for a citation for Justice Stevens. The petitioner's brief states that their minimum entitlement under their old contracts was approximately 85%. that their minimum entitlements under their new contract will be 96%. That is an increase in the amount of power they are entitled to, an increase that Congress specifically prohibited. Now, the clear language of Section 5A about all power sales, if I may take a minute, I think it's instructive to this court if we take a look at the origin of that language. The original bill that Senator Jackson sponsored merely paid lip service to preference. My clients did not support it, and because it was a Northwest bill and it didn't have regional consensus, it died. Then Senator Jackson introduced a second bill.
You're talking about the present act now, right?
Yes, I'm sorry. The second bill, which led to become the present act, did not have Section 5A in it. Senator Jackson had hearings. Representatives of my clients and other people in the Northwest and across the nation said, someone may make the exact argument that Mr. Gansreed and the petitioners have made, that preference now only applies to surplus or uncommitted power. This court should know that by definition, as described in the brief, surplus or uncommitted power is power that is not needed in the Northwest. My clients would have a preference to air. That power is power that's beyond the needs of the Northwest. That was explained to Senator Jackson. This is traced very well in the amicus brief by the APPA, the American Public Power Council, at page 24. Senator Jackson then, in the next session, because time ran out, introduced the present bill. And he said, I have listened to the Public Power Council. I was concerned that there might be some inroad on this priority, and so therefore I have inserted sections 5A and 10C to be sure that that line was drawn so that after the Congress had acted, someone couldn't subsequently come in and cross that line and take a piece of power that had been committed to the priority customers. Because prior to the Regional Act, we had both a statutory mandate to that priority to non-firm, and it was a part of our contracts. Subsequent to the Regional Act, they are given in their contracts a priority to that non-firm energy.
Mr. Waldron?
Yes, sir.
Supposing under the Bonneville Act, which was superseded by the present act, a DSI had a 20-year contract for a certain amount of power, as such a contract would have been issued under the Bonneville Act. Now, could a preference customer come in during the pendency of that 20-year contract and say, look, we've got a lot of new people that want electricity. We want you to cut in on the DSI's contract?
No, we would not have done that because the DSI's contracts provided for certain interruption rights to cover that process in case we grew and Bonneville did not have the resources. The present Regional Act expressly...
No, I'm interested in the past.
Yes, sir.
So you really agree with your opponents, then, that preference could not be used to cut into the rights of an existing DSI contract under the Bonneville Act?
That's correct. If there was an amount of power available when the administrator entered into that contract that we reasonably could not foresee, that's all mandated directly in the Bonneville Project Act. That's the section that immediately follows our express priority to all sales.
Well, then are you contending that you have greater rights to interrupt your existing DSI contracts than you had under the prior law?
No, sir.
I don't understand the two answers. It seemed to me you told Justice Rehnquist that if you had the situation we're talking about, you couldn't have gotten the power, but that you can get it today.
Perhaps I wasn't clear. Well, under our prior contracts, we had the priority to non-firm energy. They did not. They did not have an entitlement to that amount of power. That was ours, so we wouldn't have to interrupt them. Under the present contracts, the BPA administrator has reversed that priority and given that priority to the aluminum companies and taken it away from the priority and preference customers. Yes, that's correct.
And so you aren't cutting into anything. You just want what you were entitled to that he contracted away.
Yes, sir. As the Ninth Circuit pointed out, what they did was they remanded it to the Bonneville administrator to write a proper contract, which would maintain our priority, as Congress expressly stated. I think, and as we've argued in our briefs, that 5A and 10C are clear,
and that they were introduced by Senator Jackson precisely to answer their arguments. He said that in the legislative history.
May I ask another question if I reveal my stupidity, but I have some difficulty really understanding this first quartile concept. Is that something that's got a statutory foundation?
No, that is something that was devised by a person called Mr. Goldhammer, a Bonneville employee, to take advantage of some of the interruptibility of the aluminum companies. It applies to four quartiles. The top quartile is interruptible at any time.
But tell me how do you know whether a particular day's production is in the top or the bottom quartile?
1/4 of their loads is assigned to be the top quartile.
Is that 1/4 every day or the first 3 months of the year?
Every day.
Every day.
Yes, sir. And when we receive the non-firm, it's sold, so perhaps this might make it even more clear, it's sold, non-firm is sold on an hour-by-hour basis. Firm power is sold over 20 years or perhaps through yearly contracts. That's what makes it firm. On the non-firm, each hour, the BPA scheduler, if I could actually put you at Bonneville, looks at how much water is behind the dam. He looks at the preference customer's need, which on a magnitude over a year are 30 to 1,000, because we use it to keep our reservoirs full because we're in a different climate. We're on the other side of the mountains from their reservoirs, or when we're maintaining our own generation or our generation has gone down. He looks at that small amount and says, preference customers, do they need any at 5 of the hour? If they do, then he goes on down the priority. Prior to this present situation, the remainder was split equally between the privately owned utilities and the aluminum companies. Bonneville has leapfrogged the aluminum companies all the way to the top now.
Bonneville says it's Congress that has done what they're, say they're just carrying out the instructions.
Justice Rehnquist, and I think the legislative history, and we've cited it page 29, indicates 20 people in Congress, every person that sponsored the bill from the Northwest, every single one of them said one thing: we have completely protected the previous priority of my clients. Most of them also said, and now we're going to take care of the non-preference customers by giving Bonneville for the first time the right to buy power. There is not a single place in that legislative history that petitioners or the government can point to where anyone in Congress said, we are going to change this priority to non-firm energy. Section 5A, for example, in the statute, doesn't say we have priority to all power sales, except this one exception we're going to make for the aluminum companies. Section 10C, doesn't say that either. And I think it's instructive also, if we could go back to this four-year process, where, for example, the lobbyist for the aluminum companies, when they testified to Congress, their statement is, the only benefit the aluminum companies ought to receive from this legislative process is long-term contracts. That was their benefit. They used 30% of the power in the Northwest, and it was important.
But didn't
and
they
we
have,
recognized,
didn't they have long-term contracts under the Bonneville Project Act?
No, they were expiring. The first one would have expired in 1981. The act was passed December 5th, 1980. What would have happened to them, Justice Rehnquist, is they would have had to become, for 85% of them, customers of my clients. They would have then got the same service as Boeing or Weyerhaeuser or Longview Fiber, the large industries in the Northwest, the other 2,000 industries. They wanted this regional act so that they could have this relationship with Bonneville where they got this assured supply, because they, as the record is replete with, they are enormous users of electricity. And we didn't dispute that. What we dispute is where they crossed the line. This was a regional consensus. We all agreed. There is no place in the legislative history where they asked to cross this line. And there's no place in the regional act that authorizes the crossing of this line. And that is, in essence, the dispute we have. Now,
what about the provision of the statute? I don't have it in mind. It says that the power shall be deemed to be firm power for the purpose of their contract.
That was, as they described it, a legal fiction that said that there couldn't be a lawsuit initially if Bonneville hadn't been able to buy enough resources to serve them. There was no problem with that because Bonneville also had short-term purchase authority. And this was a provision that the aluminum companies authored that we would not be able to, some outsider couldn't come in and say, Bonneville, you can't enter into 20-year contracts because you haven't acquired the resources yet. What are you selling? They had short-term authority to sell them over the first few years, and then they needed to acquire the resources. And so it was a legal fiction to prevent that challenge. Now, when we're talking also about the legislative history, and again I refer to the act as being clear, I think the most instructive piece of legislative history is when the BPA administrator testified before Congress, before Senator Jackson, on the final hearing of the bill that became this act. We've quoted it at length, and I'm not going to repeat it, but the emphasis there is the BPA administrator informed Congress that this priority was expressly to be protected and that we were to have first call on the federal-based system, which is what produces the non-firm, and there was to be no change in this priority. What the act was to do was to give Mr. Monroe, the administrator, the authority to buy resources, and therefore he could meet the needs of the non-preference customers.
He didn't follow his own testimony, is that it?
He may have. He was replaced shortly thereafter. Yes, yeah. And when the election...
Anyway, his successor then didn't act in...
No, his successor adopted a different view, and as we described in our brief, also declared that there was some negotiation of contracts. He declared that that was non-negotiable. We could negotiate anything else, but that change that he said that he had to do, he said couldn't be discussed in the contract negotiations. That's pointed out in the private utilities brief. They've amplified that. One other important point, I think, is that the solicitor discussed the reserves provided. The reserves that are provided in the Regional Act are a codification of BPA's administrative practice prior to the Regional Act. That was told to Congress, and that's what Congress did. It codified it. Prior to the Regional Act, and this is quoted in our briefs, Mr. Goldhammer, who authorized these reserve provisions, described them as providing reserves to the administrator for his firm loads. The court in the Ninth Circuit in Port of Astoria versus Hodel, the only court to construe these reserves, said they provide reserves for the firm loads of the administrator. Then the Roll EIS, which Bonneville published simultaneously with the Act, describing this alternative is how it would sell power, is almost verbatim. It will provide reserves for the firm loads of the administrator. The argument on the other side is that the Regional Act changed these reserves. They are almost word for word the administrative practice and everyone in the region's understanding, including Congress. When they were translated into the contracts for the aluminum companies, they say provide reserves for the administrator. Then they get to the heart of the issue, and they say, however, power will be sold first to the aluminum companies before anyone else. And that is the change that they didn't follow from Congress. That is the change in priority that's embodied in Section 8A of the new contracts and is the heart, of this dispute. I would also like to emphasize a point I made earlier regarding its importance to us. This power, and again the ratio is perhaps 30 to 100, but this non-firm power we use, first of all, when our reservoirs are depleted, when we're not sure we can serve our firm loads because it hasn't rained on our side of the mountains. Secondly, when we have scheduled maintenance, we schedule our maintenance of our plants when we can have available BPA non-firm service. That will be dramatically changed under this situation. And thirdly, when we have a forced outage, when a plant goes down, our needs are small enough that if you don't put that 1,000-unit load ahead of us, we can almost rely upon there being small amounts, even in a drought year, of BPA non-firm that can protect our firm loads when we need it. Now, in conclusion, and I'd like to summarize it really based on the framework that this court has used in reviewing statutory construction. The Act itself is clear under our point of view. We have priority to all power sales, and nothing shall diminish that priority. Their reading is inconsistent with the plain language. They say we have priority to all sales except this non-firm, and that nothing has been diminished except this non-firm in the Northwest. As far as legislative history, the legislative history is clear equally. It says that priority will be protected, there will be a line drawn down this bigger pie, and we retain our priority to federal-based system resources which produce this non-firm. The new resources acquired by BPA or bought by BPA will go to the non-preference customers. That is clear. Their argument is that that legislative history isn't clear and that Senator Jackson didn't mean what he said or didn't know what he was saying when he inserted Section 5A into the Regional Act. The third point is the underlying policies of the Act, and that is where they are especially inconsistent. The, if I might call it the beauty of this Act, is you had a serious dispute. You had what they described as a civil war. And what happened is Congress said, okay, we attain the consensus of the priority customers by protecting their priority. But BPA has not been able to acquire any new power for a long time because there's no dams been built, so we'll give them this new authority to buy power. And therefore, BPA can go out and acquire resources and be sure that the aluminum companies may receive their 20-year long-term supply and be sure that there can be some rate relief for the privately owned utilities in the region. That, in the Ninth Circuit's opinion, harmonizes the Act well. I think, to me, it is inconceivable that a change of this magnitude was not asked for before Congress by the aluminum companies. Congress in no place ever discussed it, described it. It's not mentioned any place in the legislative history that there's going to be a change in priority.
Do you think the Ninth Circuit's opinion was quite a sensible disposition of the various issues of the case, including the treatment of the question in footnote 4 in a footnote? Do you think the Ninth Circuit opinion was a good opinion, in other words?
Yes. The reason I do, Justice Rehnquist, is that if you look at the Ninth Circuit opinion, it begins by saying the priority is clear. Congress in 5A and 10C has kept that priority, and that's as far as we need to go. Then it followed many of your and Justice White's opinions and said, to be sure, we'll give deference to BPA, and they examined it from a technical point of view and concluded that it was undisputed that we first received that priority, and they had no priority under their 1975 contracts.
And that the material treated in the footnote 4 should not have been in the text at all. It was just a footnote type of item.
I'm not obviously going to comment on how they write an opinion, but yes, it should have been in a footnote because the opinion says that the priority is clear, and that, therefore, we don't have to go beyond the priority to the equivalent amount of power. And then when they raised it, and it's the first time they ever emphasized it, was in the petition for rehearing and rehearing en banc. When they raised that at that time, then the Ninth Circuit added that footnote which basically summarizes it and says they are tied to their entitlement under their 1975 contracts. And under those contracts, they had no entitlement to this non-firm energy.
And these points, the material in footnote 4, you say was not raised until petition for rehearing?
Was not emphasized. Just as I might add, the if we're looking at consistency of administrative construction, for example, the surplus argument, the argument that we only have a right to the surplus and that 5A is basically written out of the Act as they would like, that was raised for the first time mentioned for the first time in the petition for rehearing and really briefed for the first time before this court. It wasn't in the administrator's record of decision. It's not what he relied upon. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Potocki?
Yes, Mr. Justice Berger. Let me start with the observation that the statute nowhere uses the concept firm power and nowhere uses the concept non-firm power. The assumption that somehow everything Congress was doing took those separate concepts into mind as a statutory matter, preference for one but not for the other, is, I think, a figment of the other side's imagination. What Congress mandated was contracts for an amount of power, 5D1B, for our clients. That is a concept of load capacity, not load usage, but load capacity. And it was the same amount of load capacity as existed in the then extant DSI contracts. Now, Congress intended, as BPA told him it would, that it would use non-firm power in the load, subject to interruption for protection of firm resources only, in load, in order to serve the purposes Congress intended by guaranteeing this mandated contract. And those purposes were, one, to provide rate relief, principally for people in Oregon who were being served by the private utilities, rate relief which the DSIs would have to pay for, and that's why that power getting to the DSIs was important, and also provide, through the raising of rates from wholesale to retail, essentially more profit downstream for Bonneville. Now, this was all integrated into the comprehensive legislative scheme. Congress intended specifically that a higher level of actual service be received by the DSIs through the combination of, one, a direction to Bonneville of a demand capacity, and two, a limitation in 5D1A on the circumstances under which that power could be interrupted. You can find nowhere in the legislative history, if I may return the compliment, any discussion whatsoever that by reaffirmation of preference somehow non-firm power has been kept outside of the DSI load where Bonneville wanted to put it in order to obtain the operational efficiencies and the monetary goals of the statute. You cannot find that anywhere in the legislative history. All you can find is a treaty in which all customers are going to be served by mandate of Congress, free and clear, at least for the original mandated contracts, of the old preference problems and a reaffirmation of preference for the future, preference in its traditional meaning, preference which honors lawful contracts, but preference which governs everything, including my client's rights, to any future contracts. That makes sense of the statute, and that is precisely what Bonneville did in the contracts under challenge. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.